Talk given Sunday, 10th November, 1974. Peace and war. Fear, hate, destruction and death. Immortality, liberation. Transmutation of the mind. Transcendence. Love. Wisdom, truth, beauty. What do such sounds conjure up in our minds and hearts? Today we had, this morning, a ceremonial observation of death. And one of the speakers who was narrating the scene, spoke some remarkable words of wisdom to the effect that hate, greed, pride, and such things necessitated this sort of ceremony, that these were the sources of the world's suffering and misery, the frustration of man, the denial of the fulfillment of the purpose of his existence. What do all these words which we use, the words which stand for the terrible and the awful, and the words which stand for the supremely desirable, what do they mean to us? Do they remain merely words? Do they only produce nostalgia? A vain longing which we feel half certain will never be fulfilled? Or have we turned so sour, so embittered, that we despise the very sound of these words? Let us consider together a while. It is clear to everyone that the world is moving closer and closer to disaster. You know the story of this century. Wars at the close of the last century and the beginning of this. Then that terrible Great War of 1914 to 18. And then only another generation later, another world war with widespread destruction, a destruction which was bad enough materially, but which in terms of the destruction of human values and what mankind had built up laboriously through the centuries, which was of some worth, was even more terrible than all the material destruction, because it has broken the moral backbone of the world. Of that there can be no doubt if we take the trouble to be quiet within ourselves and look. The selfness, the self-centeredness, self-orientedness of human beings has grown out of proportion altogether, just like a cancer grows. The cells proliferate wildly. The proliferation is a disease which destroys, gives pain as it takes one to death. This is the kind of thing that has happened in the world morally. It is the kind of thing which has destroyed any sort of common sense as to real values, as to ways and means by which we as human beings, as individuals first and foremost, and as social communities next, could restore our human life to some sort of order and harmony which deserves the word human. And we make the great mistake, those of us who are concerned about this, both with respect to our individual selves as well as with respect to society, we make the great mistake of searching the past to learn, as we call them, the lessons of history. Imagining that if we consider similar situations in the past, and what were the ways and means used to remedy such situations, we would have a clue to what we should do today, here and now. This is a profound error. All human situations are living situations. Living beings interacting with a living environment. Mankind has mistakenly thought of the environment, nature and so on, as dead matter, which is a profound error. It is all alive. It is all interacting with us. We are interacting with them. And in these living situations, living beings brought what intelligence they had, what perception, what vision they had, to bear upon the situation and do something to make life what? Happier for themselves, prosperous, secure, comfortable. And they bent their energies towards self-aggrandizement, either personally, to become rich, to become powerful, to rule over others, or as nations, building great empires and so forth, which have without exception been founded upon blood and conquest, upon the actions born of stupidity and hate, not of understanding which should supremely characterize human beings, and equally supremely on the foundation of love. That last is a word which is very loaded. We all think we know the meaning of the word love, and there could be no greater delusion. Our conceptions about the deep things of life emerge out of our experience as animal organisms. This psychophysical being, which is called a human being, a man, a woman, has evolved out of an animal ancestry, and it holds in its heredity all the specific qualities which characterize and distinguish animal existence. And this is an existence which obeys what we may roughly call the law of the jungle. In a sentence, it is the law which compels the living creature to draw the world unto himself for the sake of his own preservation, and additionally to propagate himself in order that the species may survive. Now, for the animal, that is right. That is how he is constituted. Nature, the good God, the power that makes all things, etc., call it what you like, made it like that. Just as that same power made the stone a stone, which doesn't speak, which doesn't do anything, which just remains stony. It made the animal like that. It made the plant like that. But out of the animal world, out of creatures, there came one creature, apparently, which underwent a development that produced us human beings. And in this production, the brain outran the development of every other aspect of the animal. And the difficulty arose this way, that the brain was harnessed in the service of desire, of what we call the natural urges, self-preservation, the preservation of the species. And in the activity of self-preservation and the preservation of the species, in that activity, there was the experiencing of pleasure, if successful, and of deep unhappiness, misery, fear, anxiety, terror, if unsuccessful. That which we liked, that to which we were attracted, which was attractive, which was attracted to us, we began to call love. A man and another man, or a woman, a grown-up and a child, they felt attraction for each other. They called it love. Man and woman joined together and lived in dependence upon each other. And if that dependence was one which turned out to be harmonious and happy, then they said, ah, this is love. But if something interfered with the pleasurableness of that dependence, what happened to that love? It disappeared. And the story doesn't end there. It turned into hate and anger, revenge. One's ego, one's vanity was offended. If fate took away the one upon whom one depended, then one wrung one's hands in grief and uselessly, vainly railed against evil powers or fate or God or whatever it was, and was miserable because of the injustice, the horribleness of life. There was no love in the world. And if one loved another and somebody came in the way and the usual triangle story came into being, there was again jealousy and hate. If in life a man saw that his friend or his brother had succeeded in life, got on, was secure and wealthy and so forth, he experienced envy. The brother or friend whom hitherto he loved was now envied. Is envy love? Or shall I put it this way? If there is love, can there be envy? Can there be jealousy? Violence? Oppression upon any human being? If there is love, can it be restricted to one? Can there be possessiveness? Can there be a demand upon the other? If there is love in its reality, can the element of measurement ever enter into it? Because this putrid thing called measurement, where love is concerned, is something which limits, which confines, which despoils. Surely have we not all felt deep in our hearts that love is immeasurable, that it is of the nature of the eternal. It is absolute. It is transcendent. It is immortal. All of which means that it never began, it never begins, it never grows, it never dies, therefore. When a man says that it hurt my feelings, or a woman says that my feelings were hurt, what does that imply? Something limited, something petty within me was upset. We have all suffered from love. If there is anyone here who has not suffered on account of that word, love, then he has some very interesting experiences in store for him. Have we ever tried to understand why it is that our feelings, as we say, get hurt? Is it not because something which we expected, something which we demanded, something which we think should be done by the other towards us, has not taken place? Has not been fulfilled, has not been done. But is this love which lays down conditions? Or is it just desire which is self-oriented, which is seeking gratification in order that one may experience pleasure? One may experience comfort or security, as we call it. Is it not one of our great illusions that we can find security anywhere? A world which comes into being, changes and dies, offers no security at all. If we seek security, we shall always be inviting insecurity into our lives. We have to face the fact of life, not only of the external world and environment, but of our own specific life, our own specific human life, in which ideas like security, happiness, fulfillment, and so on come into being. No animal knows the word fulfillment or what it means. It can't. Hasn't got that capacity to think, to understand. So, have we looked into ourselves and tried to understand why it is that our feelings get hurt? It is true that painful things may be done to us. Perfectly true. But that I get hurt means that my fine words about love is immortal, eternal, that it heals everything, are just fine words. You may say, but is not that a desirable ideal? But what kind of a mind is it which presents that argument, that it is a desirable ideal? The moment one says desirable, the question arises, what do you understand by the desirable? And if the 4,000 millions of the world today were capable of dispassionately looking into themselves, they will find that the word desirable means something which pleases me sensationally, emotionally, intellectually, and I may concede that it gives me a spiritual satisfaction. But would a man ever say that the most wonderful and desirable things are those which bring pain, frustration, dissatisfaction, conflict, insecurity. No, he doesn't. And why doesn't he? It's not merely due to common sense, as we might say. There is no common sense involved in it at all. It is simply due to the fact that we are confined, we are cruelly imprisoned in this dualistic awareness of the world and of ourselves. And we take sides with one dual against the other. That which is pleasurable to us, we accept. That which is displeasurable, we reject. And in consequence, we live in constant conflict. And we try to find ways and means to resolve that conflict, not into a true harmony, but into what we would call a harmony because it pleases us. This is one of the fundamental realities of our whole psychological existence. The psyche functions that way all the time and moves us to action along such lines. So, when we have hurt feelings, or when we say our relationships are broken or spoiled, that will be the case always, as long as there is the self-oriented, self-centered factor involved in it. Passionately we might feel, quite honestly we might feel, that, oh, it was not my fault in this situation. I did all that was possible and the other person behaved like that. True? That's what it seems like on the surface. And perhaps that's what it is to some depth also. But you know, if your eyes are really opened, then you will see that it is one's own difficulty, one's own flaw, which is responsible for this state, in addition to the other person's doing. Consider again, we are conscious dualistically. I'm using the word dualistically, but it's the universe does not display only duality but multiplicity. It's easy to just use the one word duality to mean all that. The self and the not self. And there are innumerable not selves. So we'll just say duality. There is this consciousness of the self, there is the consciousness of the other. And so long as there is this consciousness of the other, this otherness has not disappeared into unity with oneself, and oneself into unity with the other, with the so-called other, there will always be trouble, there will always be conflict. As long as there is the consciousness of otherness, there is the situation of reciprocity and a demand. If there is no consciousness of otherness, there is no reciprocity at all. There is only the transcendent unitary wholeness, holiness, here and now. Now, reciprocally, we always demand from each other. We may try to suppress the demand, but all that we succeed in doing is to push it deep down into the well of the unconscious. That is all. But it lives and thrives as a tormenting demon down there. That is hell. Wheresoever we are free of this condition of reciprocity and therefore of demand, there whatsoever happens, whatsoever is felt or thought, turns into the angels of heaven. But you see, this other is the root of conflict, which is sorrow. And reciprocity in its working out spells time. And wheresoever there is time, there is sorrow. So, this word love, how do we understand it? How do we experience it? How do we misapply it, misuse it throughout our daily lives? Is it possible to avoid misusing it so long as we are the prisoners of this dualistic awareness of existence? I and the other, the self and the not-self. Now please realize, there is no blame attached to anybody. If you want to blame somebody, you must have a peg on which to hang the responsibility. Blame evolution. Evolution did it that way. It evolved us out of an animal creature and at the same time gave us a brain and the possibility of this new transcendent world of the spirit, and never itself, that is to say the evolutionary process, make a perfect harmony between the two. That is our business. That is the whole point. It is not the business of nature to bring mind and the spirit to fulfillment. That is our individual responsibility. And this is the true, profound meaning of the word ego. I. And you will see, therefore, that there is only one I. One I am. Not I am, you are, he is. There is only the one I am. And that realization of the awareness of the one and only I am has to come into manifestation through the separate living human organism. But this is the marvel, the mystery, the beauty, the wonder of the whole evolutionary process. This is the great secret hidden in it. And it is your and my responsibility. The purpose, one of the purposes of your existence and my existence. In all this, love is involved. Because it is love that produces conflict in the first instance, in the state of blindness, in the state of darkness, in the state of groping about. And if you and I fulfill our responsibility and are really seriously concerned, and this is living the religious life, then we shall awaken to the fact that we have forgotten the transcendent truth embodied in the word I, in the term I am, and we are only conscious in separative terms. Isolative terms. I am, you are. Therefore we are in everlasting conflict. Therefore there is no love. once again, love is immortal. The immortal cannot be born, cannot begin. It cannot grow. That all that belongs to mortality, to the particular, the limited, the finite manifestation or organism or creature. Birth, death belongs to that realm. Or shall I put it this way, that the whole cycle of birth, growth and death is a little bit of the sleight of hand, the magic of the eternal transcendent, this wonderful play, this leela, as they say in India, meaning play, this mystery play of the divine, that all this should take place, but in its culmination, in its fruition, there is only the transcendent reality present. Now, if we wake up to this, or if we, I don't want to use the word try, but if we are able to wake up to this, then we'll see certain things. First and foremost, each one of us will see for himself that I do not know. When I really know, here, in my brain consciousness, in that part of me which functions in everyday life through the senses, through the logical intellectual processes, by means of speech, and through the synthesizing activity of the brain, in those terms, I know that I do not know reality, truth, the eternal. I can postulate it, but that is useless. The postulation by itself is not good enough. I may feel it. I may say, oh, my intuition tells me so. But beware, these may be great illusions. Why do so many saints undergo a fall? Why did the bright morning star, the shining angel in heaven, Lucifer himself, fall? What is the significance of such myths? We imagine we know. This is just wishful self-projection. That is why one is deluded, one is deceived, one makes mistakes. And driven by that self-delusion, one goes on and on, till at last a false step, and the whole thing crashes before us. Then, of course, we blame God. God is the whipping boy of every single human creature, sometime or other. He is the one to blame. Now, you see, first then we realize, I do not know. And when you really see that, then you don't try to achieve this or attain that. All striving in that sense, with regard to the transcendent, completely ceases. Don't try to enter the kingdom of heaven. Don't struggle to realize nirvana or perfection or enlightenment. Here in the realm of multiplicity, there is a practical thing to do, supremely practical. Be eminently watchful. The Buddha said, samasati, perfect mindfulness. And he taught it with regard to everything, all the day, every moment of the day, and even in your sleep. This is not just exaggeration. This actually is realized. In your sleep too, finally, you are mindful, in the real sense of the word. Which is a different kind of mindfulness from the waking state. Jesus said, watch and pray. You are eminently mindful of what is here and what is happening now. And that mindfulness, when it comes to fruition, is the state of awareness in which this distinction between self and not self no longer applies to you. You are at one with that you are, that which you are observing. In other words, that which you are observing is no longer outside you, an other, but you have taken it into your own being. In Christian disciplines, they say you become personally involved, totally involved personally in it. In India, we use other terminology. There is that total mindfulness, and that mindfulness applied to the world of multiplicity makes you see all the things where love is actually functioning, but is experienced by the unawakened one as pain, as hurt feelings, as sorrow, as misery, as suffering, because that person is confined to his desire to possess, to enjoy, to depend upon, to find security, and all the rest of it. But none of these things is love. That transcendent, immortal, eternal reality is the supreme creative power in the universe. It's only another name for creative power. And creative power, remember, is not something which is stored up and then used by a creator. The fundamental creative power of the universe is coterminous with, is synonymous with, is identical with actual creative action ceaselessly. That's why it's eternal. Ceaselessly. It never began. Never proceeds. Never dies. We have to just see this. Now I've talked about seeing that I do not know, about mindfulness, this watchfulness, and something else. When I really see that I do not know, and at the same time I'm awake and watchful, I do not sort of give up the ghost and in despair or say, oh well, I can't do anything about it. But I'm doing everything about it by being mindful and awake. In that state, I am truly still and silent. What is the supreme manifestation of that silence? The noise-making ego, the egoistic ego, has shut up. Notice our daily conversation. It's all about myself, isn't it? I can't go to the office, I can't come home, I can't cook a meal, I can't meet a friend, but it's all about me and my cat or my cloak or my cap or... Oh, my God, my God. Why didst thou give the gift of speech to man? The supreme lesson, the starting lesson, which continues right throughout the religious life, begins with keeping shutting one's mouth and proceeds with shutting the chatter that goes on here. To stop chattering, not to speak. It's the supreme lesson. And people will come to meetings and go join societies and meditation groups and go to teachers and so forth. And when they come back, their tongues will wag faster than ever. And more rubbishy nonsense will pour out of that tongue. And then they'll wonder why they can't find friends or husbands or wives or God knows what not, or the right employment or anything. If they'd only shut up, things would begin to come right. But they won't learn. I get silent and awake and still inside myself. I go on with my daily life, doing what is necessary only. And in that silence and stillness, because there is no isolative self-consciousness inside me, this mysterious creative power suddenly thrills and works. And you'll know it. You will be in tune with the creative pulse of life itself. Not merely as a kind of intellectual or emotional fancy, not at all. You will know it in as matter-of-fact a way, as a scientist knows exactly what is happening in the laboratory with his experiment, something actual and physical. There is perhaps an analogy which may be a little bit helpful. You take the bottom C of the piano. It's about, we'll say 24, or what is it? Six, let's say it'll be about 16 vibrations to the second. And the top C will be 4,096 vibrations to the second. Much more intensely vibrating, and the bottom C not so intensely vibrating. When you are in tune with that pulse of life, you are at 16 vibrations per second, and the pulse of life is at 4,096. But you are in tune. It is the same note, the one note. You know, when that actually happens, there is a peace that is beyond all understanding. And you will find that your whole being seems to be filled with an extraordinary energy, a power, which expresses itself in our life as understanding, first and foremost. Divest your minds of the limited meaning of understanding. Understanding means wise compassion, compassionate wisdom. The state of understanding. How wonderfully it is put, give me understanding, O Lord, and I will keep thy law unto the end. It will be impossible not to be able to keep the law unto the end under those conditions. And this understanding, this wise compassion, and this compassionate wisdom is something which makes you infinitely resilient, gives you an infinite strength to absorb anything and everything that happens. And the pain of difficult relationships, broken relationships, and so forth, all gets resolved in the right manner if this consciousness, this awareness is alive and vital in you. But if you seek the way of the world to counteract this, to put it right, to change it so that it is all right, as we say, then you will be treading the road to perdition. Because on the plane of the multiple, of the dual, you cannot bring to bear anything which truly heals, which integrates, which makes whole. Understand clearly the difference between synthesizing and integrating. You can put together, synthesize, put together mechanically, but you can integrate only livingly. This is a totally different thing. When the body is wounded, when the branch of a tree is lopped off or something, this living process heals, integrates. It's a living activity. Such is love. And the brain will never know it. It will just happen. You will exist in this ocean of love, the reality, the transcendent reality. Now be under no illusion that, oh, therefore everything will now begin to come right. It will not come right in any sense in which here with the brain we can call right. It will come right simply means it will turn into what I want it to be. No, never. That is not the way. You see, one can't love unless one sees with the closed eyes of pure wisdom. Understanding, enlightenment sees all the time, whether your eyes are open or whether your eyes are closed. There's that wonderful teaching from the days of the Rig Veda, symbolized in terms of the gods. Surya, the sun god, who shines by day. Power, resplendence, heat, energy, light, and so forth. Surya. Mitra, the sun that shines by night. Mitra means also friendship. We have the Sanskrit word maitri, the Pali metta, loving kindness. Shines by night. Look at the symbolism of it. The day signifying the conscious mind, the night signifying the unconscious, the subconscious depths of the mind, and so forth. The god of love, friendship, shines by night. And Savitri shines by both day and night. This is understanding in the supreme sense. This is love in the supreme sense. So you see, not by counteraction, not by looking at the values of the world, not by seeing how a desirable state of affairs will come, how your loved ones, so-called, will be protected and helped and saved from harm and this, that and the other, but fundamentally right into the depths. Because transcendence is the root of all that is manifest, and transcendence absorbs the whole thing all the time. Right from the depths, understand. It is only your understanding which can penetrate into this depth and transform your whole being and your life. Not in any shape that you desire, but in the shape that is essentially the rightest possible shape under the circumstance, because you have seen the divine vision, and through you, love is manifest and spreads into the world and heals it.